Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to the University of Maine Orono for this year's Distinguished Honors Graduate Lecture by Emily Kane, the Executive Director of Emily's List. The title of today's talk is The Myth of Electability: What It Really Takes for Women to Win. Emily Kane is a 2002 graduate from the Honors College at the University of Maine Orono. Before becoming the executive director of Emily's List, she served for 8 years in the Maine House of Representatives and served as a Maine State Senator in 2012. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Francois Amar, Dean of the Honors College.
Thank you so much for coming to join us for the Distinguished Honors Grad Lecture here in 2019. Before we start our program, I'd like to acknowledge our place on Marsh Island, the traditional land of the Penobscot Nation. If you were here last Friday at the fall convocation, you heard Molly-Ann Dana, the Penobscot Tribal Ambassador, provide a land acknowledgement. And as she couldn't be here today, she shared some language with me that she said I could adapt. So here goes. Akwan, welcome to Penobscot territory at the University of Maine, Orono. Land acknowledgements are always important moments to pause and reflect on how we are moving about space that Indigenous peoples have been dedicated stewards of since time immemorial. Here in this space, it is especially significant to hear these words because Marsh Island is the ancestral territory of the Penobscot Nation. The sentence that best sums up the spirit of any good land acknowledgement is, and I quote, "Indigenous people have always been here and always will be." I invite all of us here today to learn more about the original people of this land, the members of the Penobscot Nation, who are very much here today. It is my pleasure to welcome Emily Kane as the 2019-2020 TIAA Distinguished Honors Graduate Lecturer. Emily graduated from UMaine and Honors in 2002 with a degree in music education. She was one of those students whose influence was immediately felt all over campus, and I think that's probably a great understatement. but for example, she was a founder of the women's singing group Renaissance, which continues to this day. She was active on the Honors Student Advisory Board. She was an RA in Honors and in many, many other capacities. Upon graduation, she was, along with Sarah Paul, one of the first cohort of Honors Associates here in the college. Emily, who was first elected to office at age 24, made her mark in Maine politics, serving in both the House and Senate over 5 terms in the state legislature, leading the Appropriations Committee as chair, and serving as the youngest woman House Minority Leader in state history. But Emily Kane's story is a lot more personal for us here in Honors. During the period 2002 to 2014, she worked for the Honors College as the coordinator of advancement and worked closely with Dean Charlie Slavin, with Barbara Willett and Deb Small, who are here with us today, and many others to forge the relationships that would prove so instrumental in creating the traditions of the college, including, yes, indeed, this very tradition. So Emily was a student here before Honors became a college and then contributed immensely to the transition to becoming a college. After a decade of experience as a state legislator and public policy leader, more than a decade of work in higher education, and recent leadership as chief strategy officer for a private sector tech company, Emily joined Emily's List, I'll let her explain that, as executive director. She splits her time between Washington, D.C. and Orono, where she lives with her husband, Danny Williams, and their dog, Bartlett the Pug. So Emily, welcome back to the University of Maine and to the Honors College. It's been such a pleasure to have you here, to catch up a bit, and to get your perspective on current happenings in D.C. and around the country. We're eager to hear more on your topic, the myth of electability, what it really takes for women to win, and we will have a Q&A after the talk.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much. This is such a treat for me to be here. Thank you to Francois and to the team in the Honors College for inviting me, especially to Francois. When he sent me a note about this I think my response was, oh my gosh, really? Me? It's my time to give the honors lecture? This is amazing. It is very surreal for me to be back on campus, even though I live a mile from here on Main Street, to be back in this capacity as the Distinguished Honors Graduate Lecturer. I've had a great day on campus today. I got to have breakfast with honor students, meet with honors faculty, spend time in Amy Fried's Women in Politics class, meet with Rachel and Harley from the Margaret Chase Smith Center about a very cool project they're doing about Margaret Chase Smith's recipes. Totally neat. I want all the recipes. Some of them are kind of gross, to be honest, but I really would like to try some of them, not all of them. But it's really surreal for me because the first one of these lectures happened during my senior year in college with Jim Tierney, as Francois mentioned, and I helped plan that event. I remember when Charlie Slavin, who was the dean of the Honors College at the time, came up with this idea. Jim Tierney was the longest serving attorney general in Maine history, someone who I later became friendly with, and who supported me when I ran for office. And he's gonna be here on October 2nd and 3rd, so you should totally come see him. And to follow in the footsteps of lecturers who then, for more than a decade, whose events I helped plan, is amazing. People like Dr. Carolyn Reed, Charles Stanhope, who's here today, George Single, the Honorable Judge George Single, Nobel Peace Prize winner Dr. Bernard Laun, Dr. Kristen Gwynne Becker, and more. And even being on this stage, where I performed in musicals like Into the Woods and Cabaret. Yes, I was a Kit Kat girl in Cabaret once upon a time. On this stage, a very different outfit, I want to tell you that. I really do love my job. And over the past 2+ years since joining Emily's List, we've grown our staff by more than 30% to more than 100 full-time staffers. Men work at Emily's List too. I know some of you are wondering this. Yes, 80% women, 20% men. We had to knock down a wall in our office to make room for the team needed to do our important work. And we had our most successful election cycle ever. So while this past November of 2018 was the first time for me in 14 years that my name did not appear on the general election ballot, yeah, 2004, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, and 16. I am confident that right now I am in the right place. Being Emily from Emily's List is pretty great. Let me tell you a little about Emily's List. So Emily's List has been working to elect pro-choice Democratic women for almost 35 years. Thank you. In 1985, there had never been a Democratic woman elected to the United States Senate in her own right, and a woman named Ellen Malcolm decided to change things. Newsflash, how many of you, tell me the name of the first woman ever elected to the U.S. Senate in her own right? Margaret Chase Smith? Yeah, I thought so. Great. You all passed Maine history. But she was a Republican, which is great. It's great she was there. Democrats had not sent a woman to the Senate in her own right in 1985. Ellen Malcolm decided to change that. Ellen built a network to elect pro-choice Democratic women. The first meeting of the group was in her basement. Her friends came over with their Rolodexes. For those of you in the Honors 111 class, that's your contacts app in a physical form, held together by cheap plastic that sits on your desk with loose note cards. It's not a great system, but it's what they had in 1985, and so these women got together and decided to write and ask their friends to commit to supporting Democratic women early in their campaigns. Why? Because early money is like yeast. E-M-I-L-Y. It's a baking joke. Early money is like yeast. It makes the dough rise. Got it? You like this. See, you can't forget. In fact, our original logo was modeled after the exact Fleischmann's yeast packet. True story. And so these women found strength in numbers and in 1986 elected Barbara Mikulski as the first from Maryland, as the first Democratic woman senator ever elected in her own right to the U.S. Senate. So fast forward to 1991. when Anita Hill, an African-American law professor, courageously spoke up about sexual harassment in a U.S. Senate hearing, starting a wave of women that hit in 1992, which was called the Year of the Woman. You see, an all-male Senate Judiciary Committee aggressively, disrespectfully had questioned her, and ultimately they dismissed her. The boss she spoke out against, Clarence Thomas, was then confirmed to the United States Supreme Court. A woman bringing credible allegations against a Supreme Court nominee who was ignored and then he was confirmed. Does any of this sound familiar to you? But women across the country were watching. They were outraged. Women voters were determined to make their voices heard in the halls of power, and women were inspired to run and win in record numbers. Emily's List helped elect 4 new women senators and 20 new women into the U.S. House in 1992. And our list grew by more than 600% to more than 23,000 members. The women we have elected in our 35 years have changed policies, and they have changed Congress itself. They've claimed space for themselves and made space for future women leaders. In fact, until Barbara Mikulski led the, quote, pantsuit rebellion of 1993, women were not allowed to wear pants on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Her colleague, Senator Patty Murray, who you see there on the left, said it best: the rule had to change, not her. As the women have kept coming, more and more rules have had to change. Even as recently as 2009, so 10 years ago, women senators could not use the pool in the congressional gym because some of their male colleagues liked to swim naked. Yeah. Thanks to former Senator Kay Hagan, the men-only sign was changed to, quote, proper attire required. And when Senator Hagan left the office, her female colleagues threw her a pool party at the congressional pool. In 2013, so only 6 years ago, the restroom closest to the Senate floor that was set aside for women only had 2 stalls. With 20 women in the Senate at that point, traffic jams were common. Always multitasking, the women held impromptu strategy sessions when they were stuck in line, but they had had enough, and they spoke up, and now they have nicer and more spacious facilities. And just last year, you'll see there in the middle, that's Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois. She became the first U.S. senator ever to give birth while in office. So senators are required to vote in person, but Senate rules did not allow babies on the Senate floor. So she asked Senator Amy Klobuchar, the senior Democrat on the Senate Rules Committee, to change the rules so she wouldn't have to choose between caring for her baby and casting votes, literally bringing her baby on the floor to cast the vote and then bringing the baby off the floor. After answering questions and addressing concerns, ranging from, but what if there are 10 babies in the Senate? To which Amy responded, that would be a delight. To the baby dress code, which, for the record, babies can wear hats and do not have to wear shoes, the senators voted unanimously to change the rule and finally allow babies. There we go. So today, Emily's List is our nation's largest resource for women in politics. To date, we have raised more than $600 million to elect pro-choice Democratic women candidates. With a grassroots community that now numbers more than 5 million members, Emily's List helps Democratic women win competitive campaigns across the country, up and down the ballot, by recruiting and training candidates, supporting strong campaigns, researching the issues that impact women and families, and turning out women voters to the polls. Since our founding in 1985, we have elected 150 women to the U.S. House, 26 to the U.S. Senate, 16 governors, and nearly 1,100 women to state and local office. Nearly 40% of the candidates Emily's List has helped to elect to Congress have been women of color. Yeah. And during the historic election of 2018, Emily's List raised a record-breaking $110 million and launched a record independent expenditure campaign of $46 million. That led to 34 new women entering the U.S. House, including 24 flips. In case you were counting, weren't counting, I was. We needed 23 seats to flip the House control, and we flipped 24 with women, so women actually flipped the House. And that was enough to deliver the House majority. So we have a new normal now, right? This is a new normal that we're living in. A new normal means we will always have multiple qualified women running for president, always. It means you should never turn on the TV and see images of Congress that do not include a diverse group of women. It means we won't have legislative committees working on policy issues like healthcare that don't have any women on them. It means more women running for office up and down the ballot across the country, and it means more governors, like our governor, Janet Mills. And it means that 2018 was not another year of the woman that was a wave, it means it was a sea change, and we're only just getting started. I mean, if you look at this image, this diverse group of women wearing white to the State of the Union, the color of suffragettes, this is the new normal, and we gotta get used to it. But how did we get here? We got here with Hillary Clinton. She ran for president. Donald Trump won. Millions of women marched on Washington and across the country. Charlottesville and the stark contrast between those who stand up against racism and those who say there are fine people on both sides became clear. We have Time's Up and Me Too and women speaking their truth no matter how hard it is. We have Parkland and Mueller and Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And meanwhile at Emily's List, things were changing too. Since the 2016 election, more than 49,000 women have reached out to Emily's List to say they want to make a plan to run for office, laying the groundwork for the next generation of candidates for office all across the country. Yes, I said 49,000 and growing every day. And for comparison, because you're like, oh, is that really a lot? By comparison, in the 2015-2016 election cycle, it was 920. 920 to now 49,000 and counting. There were 12 yesterday. I get an email every day telling me how many people signed up. Yesterday was 12. So we now have generations of future candidates lined up to flip targeted legislative, gubernatorial, and congressional seats over time. And yes, that includes the White House. These women are our future leaders. We are planting seeds. We are forcing the change. We have so many new normals. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Abby Finkenauer, Katie Hill, and Lauren Underwood, some of the youngest members of Congress ever elected. Veronica Escobar and Sylvia Garcia, the first two Latinas ever elected from Texas. Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, the first two Muslim women ever. Ayanna Pressley and Jahana Hayes, the first African-American women to represent New England. Kim Schreier is the only woman doctor in Congress. She's from Washington. Charisse Davids, the first openly LGBTQ woman of color in Congress and one of the first two Native American women ever to serve in Congress, along with Deb Haaland. Angie Craig, the first openly lesbian mom. And Pennsylvania, it's a big state, you might have heard of it, it's pretty giant, forefathers there, Independence Hall, right? Pennsylvania had zero women in their federal delegation. Zero. 2018 happened, and now they have four. Madeline Dean, Chrissy Houlihan, Mary Gay Scanlon, and Susan Wild. But aren't we close to equal yet? Nope. Just in case you were getting really excited and feeling like everything was okay, we're not even close. The success of 2018 can definitely be summed up in one word, and that is women. And these women and the stories they told and the barriers they broke through are amazing. But those wins and firsts and excitement do not tell the whole story. Because what every woman knows is that despite the marching, Me Too, Time's Up, and winning elections, we still face sexism every day. Even those groundbreaking women who ran and won in 2018 dealt with misogyny, sexism, and challenges based on their gender every day. Consider this. Women have had the right to vote since 1920, and a century later, after an election in which women made unprecedented gains, the United States House of Representatives is still dominated by men who make up more than 3/4 of its members. Of the nearly 2,000 people who have served in the United States Senate since the founding of our country, 56, or 2.8%, have been women. And only 325 of the more than 11,000 members of the House have been women since our country was founded. It was not until 1981 that a single woman served on the U.S. Supreme Court. That was Sandra Day O'Connor. Now there are three, one-third of a court making decisions every term on women's fundamental rights. There's been only one woman Speaker of the House, one woman major party presidential nominee, and no women elected president or vice president yet. Of course, this is not limited to politics. I want to be clear. The Fortune 500 list has been around for six decades. In 2018, there were just 24 women CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. And that was a 25% decrease from the all-time high of 32 in 2017, out of 500. It's not good. But we're seeing that it's not just the statistics. Because our candidates face questions and assumptions that men don't. Like, how are you going to balance work and family? They get judged and they get demeaned based on their appearance or their tone of voice. If they are mothers, they are all of them at some point asked a question that's almost never raised of fathers running for office, which is, how are you going to take care of your children if you win? If they are not mothers, they are invariably asked, when do you plan to have children or why don't you have children? Again, not a question usually asked of childless men. One of our candidates, now governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, was even asked, are you going to run as a woman? She's very kind, and she understood what the question was, really, because a question like that, obviously, is a silly question, but what it really means behind is, are you only going to run on women's issues? And she ran a campaign, a successful campaign of governor of Michigan, where her campaign slogan was, and I quote, fix the damn roads. Great campaign slogan, and she won. But the new normal means women and girls can no longer be deterred by the belief that women are somehow in a separate lane to be judged differently. It means they'll be valued on who they are and what they care about, not by outdated gender stereotypes. It means all of us learning collectively that all women are not the same. All women are not the same. And take the current presidential primary. The women candidates face questions of electability, likability, authenticity, all code words for, this is a type of candidate that I have not encountered before. That's also called sexism, in case you were wondering. So let's talk about electability. So for a lot of this year, instead of debating the policies or the experiences of the candidates in the Democratic presidential primary, we've been debating an increasingly flawed metric, electability. Unfortunately, that debate wrongly assumes that the women in the field are just less electable than certain men. And that's just plain wrong. But let's talk about electability. What is it? Is it having the highest name recognition? No. Is it who's in the polls on the top today, right now? Nope, it's not. Is it someone who looks like a leader I've seen before? Definitely no. It's still too early to know what the environment for 2020 will be for the presidential race. And the fact that no one is good at predicting electability, I mean, no one is good at predicting electability, especially voters and pundits and journalists. I mean, if you think about it, Barack Obama and Donald Trump were both considered to be unelectable until they got elected. Off-year polls in previous elections had Gary Hart beating George Bush, Walter Mondale beating Ronald Reagan, and Bob Dole beating Bill Clinton. Electability is unfair and it is unhelpful. It is code for candidates that look like what we're used to. It's ensuring that women face an unfair disadvantage, and it has nothing to do with their actual campaigns or their candidacies. But can a woman win, right? Can a woman win? The truth is women are electable, very electable, in fact. How do we know this? America did vote for a woman. While she lost the presidency thanks to 80,000 votes in key three states, Hillary Clinton earned 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. America voted for more women in 2018. Women won statewide and flipped House seats in key states like Minnesota, Arizona, Nevada, and in fact, the only woman to have a, the only person to have a statewide Democratic victory in Florida in 2018 was a woman named Nikki Fried. Women have also won in the key states that Donald Trump won in 2016. In Michigan, Democratic women won, listen to this, every major statewide election except one, including Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who we talked about a minute ago. In Wisconsin, despite millions of attack ads, Tammy Baldwin handily won re-election to the U.S. Senate. And in Pennsylvania, formerly the largest state with no women, four women were elected to the U.S. House. The thing is, America has voted for the women running for president. Unlike most of their male opponents, all three of the women senators in the race have never lost an election. Electable doesn't really mean what you think it does. A big part of winning the presidency is generating excitement. It's generating additional votes from the voting base, particularly women. In fact, in 2018, Emily's listed a big survey and poll post-election. And what we found was that 54% of voters in our battleground races were women. So in those tough seats I talked about earlier, 54% of our voters were women. And we saw double-digit swings with those women, both college and non-college educated women, coming to vote for Democratic candidates. At Emily's List, we continue to empower women to tell their story and find strength in who they are and what they have to offer. Electability is not what we should be talking about in this election or in any election. So what do we do about this, right? What do we do about this? It's actually not very complicated. So this is a map of the country. And what you see are states highlighted by redistricting. So redistricting happens after the census in 2020, and we get to redraw maps. So at Emily's List, what we are focused on as a way to challenge and make change, we are focused on recruitment. Because I'm going to fill you in on a little secret. Women can't win if their names are not on the ballot. Seriously, did you know that? You can't win an election if you don't actually run? So at Emily's List, we're very, it's a true fact. We are very, yeah, well, Lisa Murkowski's a great example. She got herself on the ballot. Look at that. She got herself on the ballot. She got her name on the ballot. She got enough people to learn how to spell Murkowski to write her name, which is a long, complicated name, to win that election. Right? She got her name on that ballot. And so you can't win if you can't get the votes to win. So, and have your name out there. So at Emily's List, we are recruiting, building our success on our success of last cycle, where we flipped 7 legislative chambers across the country. We've announced a $20 million investment in state legislative races during the next 14 months. That starts with Virginia this coming November and means working to flip or hold chambers where legislators play a role in redistricting. Because that's how we get fairer maps. We do a lot of trainings. At Emily's List, we've trained more than 10,000 women already to run for office, but now we've expanded the tools available to reach more women across the country. In addition to our in-person trainings, we now offer an online training center and Facebook community that offers accessible and real-time support for women running at all levels of office. We also support women. Supporting candidates at Emily's List means more than just money, although early money is like yeast. It does make the dough rise. To be clear, and the money matters a lot, in the last election cycle, we raised $12 million directly for our federal and gubernatorial candidates. We contributed more than $4 million directly to campaigns and spent $46 million through our Super PAC, Women Vote. But we work with women for their whole careers, through wins and losses, to help them continue to make a difference. An example of that, United States Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona is someone who we not only elected to the Senate last year, but we helped elect her to the U.S. House in 2012 and supported her as a state legislator even before that. Emily's List support is personal and it is ongoing. It's also really important to be what we like to call a happy warrior. This is our governor, Janet Mills. I believe she is the happiest governor in America. She loves her job, and I love my job. Every week when I fly to DC, so normally my usual schedule is I get up at the crack of crack on Mondays, and I go to the Bangor Airport where I know everyone. They're so nice there. You should love the Bangor Airport. And I get on a flight that leaves before 6 in the morning. I'm in my office at my desk by 8:45. Most weeks, I'm lucky enough to see people I know who are headed to DC for work or travel or a conference. And almost weekly, I get asked, Emily, isn't it hard to work in DC right now? My answer is always, no, it's amazing. I have the best job. My job is fundamentally to save democracy by electing women. And we have so much to accomplish, and I mean it. And so I look at Janet Mills, and she is working so hard for the people of Maine, and she is loving every minute. We have to do this work with joy, because it is worth it. If you just watch the news all the time, you will be sad all of the time. Okay? Do things that make you joyful. If you watch cable news all of the time, you will be sad. Find the way to get your information, and then also find a way to stay in the zone that keeps you moving forward. It's hard out there right now. It's overwhelming, right? So today, my hope is, as you hear me talk about all of this, that you'll have some takeaways. My hope is you'll have a takeaway that while women have won a lot of elections, we're only just getting started and actually still have a really long way to go to get to equality. My hope is that you will now see that electability is a silly way of judging who should be president of the United States of America. My hope is that you will notice sexism and unfair standards that women are being judged by in the media and call them out when you see them or when you hear them from your friends. Ask them, what makes you think that? And I hope you also maybe feel a little more optimistic today about the future for women in politics in America because of the work of Emily's List. But I would argue that the new normal can't just be about women in politics. The momentum for the fundamental shift that we need for the role of women can ripple not just across government, but across the private sector, across education, across business, across communities, across our country. This new normal means we have to celebrate the wins and the firsts, but then we have to have the seconds and the thirds and the fourths and the fifths until it is business as usual. We have to still shine a light on the challenges that women face every single day. It means that we question business as usual everywhere, to make sure not just women, but members of the LGBTQ community, people of color, people of different religions, people who come from less affluent backgrounds, people with disabilities, people with different levels of education, and more, all have access to a seat at the table. So for me, more women getting elected, it's just the start. That's the Honors College 75th anniversary celebration. Because it brings me back to the community that brought me here, to the community that supports me today, the community that I'm still a part of because I live here. And I'm so happy that I could spend this time with you. So I'm gonna stop now, because this is a class and it is a lecture and you get to ask me questions. But I wanna just say one more time, thank you. And to all of the first year honor students are here, who are here today in your Honors 111 class, I wanna say thank you for choosing honors. Something that people often misunderstand about the Honors College is it is not something you have to do. You are a high school student who worked hard, and you got invited to be a part of an experience that you opted into. And a lot of other people were invited who did not make the same choice. So give yourself credit for making that choice. Dig into this experience. Get to know the other people in your classes. You will still know them. In fact, one of them, Jenny Woodard, is here. She was in my very first, I met her my very first day of college, and she in honors, and she's here today. You get to know people you will know for the rest of your life. And I'm very, very lucky that I got to spend a little time with you today. So let me take your questions now. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features Emily Kane addressing the future of women in our political landscape. She will now answer questions from the audience, which she summarizes in her responses.
Yes, right here in the front. question is about campaign staffing. And what is Emily's List doing about the fact that there are not actually very many women who work in campaign staffers, as campaign staffers, and the sort of movement within campaign staffing around unionization? Two-part question. First part, Emily's List actually is very committed to changing the dynamic. So here's the thing. We think about privilege in a lot of ways. Campaigns are tough work, right? Means you gotta pick up, be able to move at a minute's notice. You kind of sleep on a couch for a little while. It's rough. You gotta support her housing. You gotta figure it out. Move to a new town. You know who can afford to do that? People who have money. And people who actually don't have any student debt can afford to work on campaigns. So you know what you get on the campaigns? A lot of people who have money, whose parents paid for them to go to college completely, right? Who didn't have to work three jobs. You get a lot, quite frankly, you get a lot of dudes on campaigns. It's just a fact. That's just me being objective. But so at Emily's List, what we're doing is we have a very aggressive internship program. We pay $1,200 a month for our interns. That's a change I made since coming to Emily's List. We used to pay them $400 a month. Now we pay them $1,200 a month, 25 to 30 interns. You should all think about applying. Yes, men are interns at Emily's List too. It's awesome. And we work to put those people and give them real life experience on campaigns, which gives them a leg up. We also pay them so that they can actually not take on additional debt while they're doing that. We also work with our campaigns through a national job bank that we have and resume bank that we keep at Emily's List to help identify talented women staffers and train them up. We have the preeminent finance director training in the country for political campaigns that, again, we work to keep that a very diverse room. The second piece about campaign unionization, this is something that is happening on some campaigns across the country, not in others. It is something we think is great, and it's a choice that campaigns make. And that is that's a thing that happens on its own, but we think it's fine, and it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. Does having a major that was not politics or history or something make me better at my job? You know what? I don't know, because I don't know any other way, right? I mean, what I will tell you is I served in the legislature with amazing people who majored in political science and in history, and who were lawyers and bankers and lobstermen and had college educations and didn't have college educations. What makes you a good public servant is that you want to work hard for people. So I think what made me good at it is I knew why I got out of bed every day. What made me run for the legislature when I was 24 years old was that I cared a whole lot about you. Specifically, you, college students in Maine. Because of my experience here at the university and in honors, I was able to see, in my own experience, and watching my family try to afford college, right? That's what, still to this day, that's what gets me going when I think about public policy. That's why I want to work on the economy. That's why I wanted to be in office, right? Campaigning is not glamorous. It actually is pretty miserable. Politics is not a way to make a lot of money. Right? You don't get really famous. That's actually not a thing. It's just very nerdy. People will know who you are. No one else. It is not glamorous work. So you have to want it for more than just a title. And in Maine, you make $10,000 a year and you share a staff with 15 other people. So it's not even like you have an office, right? So for me, having a major was something I was passionate about is why I was a good public servant. Right, and why I like to recruit women and support candidates, men and women, who are passionate about something enough to get through all the hard parts. You have to be driven by something other than yourself, and that's what makes a good public servant. Over here. Question was, do people outside of this country, from other countries, ask us to help them? We are a federal PAC, so we can't. By FEC laws, we can't interfere in federal and other foreign elections. We don't do that. We don't want them interfering in ours. That is just again, fact. But here's what we can do is we do, you know, all of our information on the internet is public, and we do often groups who are from other countries who will come to the US to DC, who tour Democratic and Republican organizations will want a stop at Emily's List to understand what we do and the difference that we've made. Because even despite our work, the U.S. is still woefully behind a lot of other countries who have women's representation in government, but they don't have the system we do financially to do this. There is an Emily's List Australia. They're not like sanctioned by us. They are just copycatted us a long time ago. We couldn't really do anything about it. So. And we had an intern from them last year, which was actually kind of cool. But the answer is no, and we can't. We're not an international organization. Good question. Yep. Overrepresentation of healthcare and childcare. That is a great opportunity for equalizing in the gender field as well, right? I mean, we can see more men. The same way we need to expose more women to careers in STEM. We need to also make it just as socially acceptable for men to choose childcare as their career, right? Women are not the only ones who can be good at caring for children. Men are good at it too. And we can do more of that as well. And I think that is where we have a long way to go in our country when it comes to gender stereotypes and how they fit into boxes for careers. And that, again, does not just apply to politics. That's certainly the area that I'm most passionate about. And in healthcare, I mean, it depends on sort of which area. There certainly are more women nurses, right? It's still sort of a novelty if you end up at the hospital, God forbid, and you have a male nurse. People still think that's kind of weird. It's not weird. It's great, right? Men can be nurses, too. So I think it's the same philosophy that applies. And in the same way that Emily's List is deliberate about this work is the same way that other fields, you have to be deliberate. Right, you have to invite people who don't look like and come from the same background that you already have to be a part of this, because it does not happen on its own. Otherwise, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy and just continues. But that's a great question. Thank you. Yeah. So Emily's List, our mission has been the same since day one. We support pro-choice Democratic women. That is the side on which we work. There was an Emily's List version on the Republican side called the Wish List, which once there was the sort of pre-Tea Party, once actually, quite frankly, the Republican Party put anti-choice legislation so far into their platform and embedded it there, the Wish List could no longer get funded. It was run by people who used to be affiliated with Olympia Snow and others, some of whom still live in Maine, who I know very well, who are friends of mine, but it ceased to be able to get support. Right, and when you have the difference of a party platform that so fundamentally excludes women in such a deliberate way, it's not a surprise. So at Emily's List, also the way our political system is set up with political parties makes sense. There are also, by the way, a lot of organizations that do what we do, but in a bipartisan way. Groups like She Should Run, the Center for American Women in Politics, the Yale Campaign School. We can also look at groups like Planned Parenthood and NARAL, who support pro-choice candidates, period, despite party, despite gender. There are a lot of groups that do this in a nonpartisan and bipartisan way. Emily's List role is specific and is unique, and I'm very proud of our work. Yes? It's a great question about money in politics, asking about shouldn't we, you know, money of course plays a role, shouldn't we try to get to a place where money does not play such a role and we don't have such sort of big, outsized corporate and otherwise influence. Did I get your question? Absolutely. I mean, as a Maine state legislator, I was a clean elections candidate all five of my terms. I collected $5 checks from people in my district. I spent under $7,000 on each of my House races, not even, I think, maybe 30,000 total on my Senate race when I ran for 23 towns in one here in Penobscot County. Absolutely. I wish we could roll back the clock on Citizens United. Absolutely. Thank you. I also do not believe in entering a fight without bringing all my tools with me. So I will play by the rules that exist. The rules include super PACs. Emily's List has one. The rules include individual contributions up to a certain amount. The rules include PAC contributions. I applaud and support the candidates who are choosing to not take corporate PAC contributions, for example, and the work of groups like End Citizens United that I'm a big fan of. But we also have to make sure that we are not naive and pretend that somehow just because we don't like the outsized influence of money in politics, that the other side's going to be like, yeah, you're right, that's good, I'm not going to do it either. That's not what they're going to do. Newsflash. So I agree with you completely, and it's one of the reasons why I'm so proud of the fact that where we have been able to elect these women, these are the women who are championing the kinds of change that you're talking about and looking for, particularly when it comes to corporate and Citizens United. Yes. Oh, being an Emily's List intern. Great. Emily'sList.org. Please go to our website where you will then go to the Get Involved tab. And down there's I've been there a few times, jobs and internships. Click on that. And at the bottom of that page, you will see where you can apply to be an intern. Again, we take 25 to 30 interns in the spring, in the summer, and in the fall. And you can apply there. And if you don't get the first time, apply again. And make sure you let Francois or Melissa know that you've applied so they can tell me, so I know that. We get a lot of applications. I'm looking over here. Yeah. Common discussion about white women and the role they played in 2016. That's what the question is about. Do we play a role in that? And the answer is yes. In fact, we do research out of our women vote arm, the Super PAC arm, on women voters, some of which is that research I was just talking about. Because we want to understand. We want to understand why women voted the way they did or didn't in 2016, and what that means for the future. Because one of the things we also know is that voters are not frozen in time. In one election, just because you voted for a Democrat or a Republican or a man or a woman does not mean you will vote for only that kind of candidate for the rest of your life. Because you change and you grow. And what we saw in the election in 2018 is that the issue of healthcare was by far and away the number one issue, hands down, in every demographic, in every part of the country. And what we saw that were candidates who were able to talk authentically about healthcare and advocate on healthcare issues in a real way were able to get votes from everybody, right? So at Emily's List, we work to understand what are the dynamics, what is the context in the particular election in a forward-looking way so that we can help advise our candidates on the best way to connect with those voters and build the coalition necessary to win, particularly in tough places. Yes, in the back. So the question is about women's executive leadership. And I'll tell you, this is a tough one. I mean, we have seen, so Emily's List had our best gubernatorial win cycle last year. Whenever we elected 6 Democratic governors across the country, reelected 2 and elected 4 new ones. And it was, but we lost several gubernatorial primaries to even get to that many. Right? I mean, we lost a primary in Nevada that was awful. You know, it was really hard. We lost primaries around this country. And we know from focus groups and polling that there's still this disconnect of women and women executive leadership. We saw that play out in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. We see that in the same discussion of electability now. It falls in that same category of, she's great and I trust her to make laws, but does she really have what it takes to be in charge? Right? That is still a barrier. And unfortunately, I will say at Emily's List, the only way to change that perception is to barrel down right, like to push right through it. I mean, we have no choice but to keep contending in these elections. We cannot abdicate it. We have to keep pushing it. And we have to use the examples we have of governors like Michelle Lujan Grisham in New Mexico, the first Democratic woman of color to ever be elected governor, Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, Kate Brown in Oregon, Janet Mills in Maine, Gina Raimondo in Rhode Island, Laura Kelly. Did you know the governor of Kansas is a former teacher named Laura Kelly? How cool is that? But we've got these women, and none of them were the usual suspects, right? We also, it's one of the reasons that Emily's List, we're working so hard on the pipeline of statewide elected officials, secretaries of state, attorneys general, treasurer, auditor, positions like that, lieutenant governor, positions like that, like in New York, I was in New York yesterday with Attorney General Tish James and Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul. The more we see women in statewide elected office, the better off we are. So that's why we are pushing the pipeline. It is also a pure numbers game. And if you think about a state like Maine only has one statewide state elected office, governor, our treasurer, attorney general, secretary of state, auditor are all elected by the legislature. It's unique. I was part of it. It's cool. But it doesn't build you a pipeline of women who can run for statewide office, and it's different than running for the Senate, which is the other one we have. So it's a numbers game. It's why we're so big on the pipeline work that we're doing around the country, and why we will keep pushing at that glass ceiling until we bust it open all the way. Other questions? I'm looking. It's hard to see. Oh, over there. It's a great question. So I'll tell you, I don't know yet. The question is about, is the swing that happened in the midterm sustainable into 2020? I don't know. There's no question that Donald Trump could get reelected, right? I mean, look at controversial political figures across this country, including right here in Maine. Maine's own Governor Paul LePage, who people thought could never get reelected. He did. He got more votes the second time than the first time. He did, right? We had third-party candidates. It was a little bit different. The reason I believe there is a path to defeating Donald Trump, regardless of who is on the ticket, but especially if there's a woman on the ticket, is because what we saw out of 2018 came out of all those things I talked about, Parkland, Charlottesville, Brett Kavanaugh, right, all of these things. And those things have kept happening. So we're not talking about igniting a flame here. We're talking about pouring gasoline on a bonfire. This bonfire has not simmered down at all. Those 49,000, 49,000 means that there have been over 8,000 women who have signed up with Emily's List just since last November, right? I mean, they have not stopped. They are still showing up for marches. Look at the climate marches that happened across this country, right? The reason I think it is possible is because, number one, he's still the president. And that is a uniting factor, even for people who are critical of various Democrats running for president. And number two, those coalitions that have formed have really, they're intersectional, right? We're having these conversations about the intersection of race and class and climate change and sexism and discrimination based on whether you are LGBTQ or not, right? We're having these intersectional conversations. And quite frankly, another major factor, I'm looking at all of you in the honors class, are the young people coming out of high school right now who are very different than ones who were coming out of high school 4 years ago. They see different, they are engaged in different ways and activated in different ways on social media platforms, activated in different ways by issues, and seeing themselves represented on TV, whether it's with Greta, who, I always say her last name wrong, Climate Change Greta, we'll call her Climate Change Greta because I don't want to butcher her last name, or Emma Gonzalez from Parkland in Florida, they see young people who look like them and say, these grown-ups are getting it wrong, I'm going to do it better. So I think there is a coalition opportunity in 2020 that that has not been a part of our dialogue and experience before in a presidential election year in this way. And that's why, and I also, we're seeing it across the country, even in the small dollar contributions that are coming in to support our candidates. It's sustained as well. Yes, right here. Who's my favorite? Oh, such a loaded question. So Emily's List is not endorsed, and Emily Kane has not endorsed. I don't feel the need to know yet who the presidential candidate is. I really, this is me being honest, and my husband will tell you, he and I have this conversation, this is the same thing I say at home. I don't actually know. I know that I want somebody who can sustain the coalition and go keep the coalition going. I know that I believe we need a ticket that absolutely is diverse in gender and in having a person of color, right, in order to keep our coalition together and to be the best version of ourselves as we head into this election. And I believe we need somebody who's probably not a usual suspect, right? And so that puts a handful of people in my top tier. I actually know a lot of them personally, which is super cool, including like Pete Buttigieg. I've known him for years. I've met Cory Booker. I know Kamala. I know Elizabeth. I'm very excited. But so I don't know, and I'm not ready to know. I don't feel the need to know yet. And I got to go to the first debate in Miami. It was in the third row. If you watched, I was sitting on Chuck Todd's shoulder basically during the whole debate. And I'll tell you, I love the pomp and circumstance. I love the people watching, the spectacle of it all. But I left there feeling so confident in the team. I felt so good. And so that's why I don't need to pick my horse yet. And I'm not trying to dodge the question. I actually do not have a favorite. I have a grouping of favorites. So thank you for the question. And you should all keep checking it. As the chairman of the Democratic Party says, I encourage you to date around, he says. He says, don't get exclusive yet in this primary. He's like, speed date all of them. I think that's what you should do.
Maybe we have time for one more question, and then we have a little ceremonial stuff here at the end.
Who wants the final? Over here? Yes, go ahead. The different types of primaries? So there are a lot of different primaries around the country, open, closed. The one in California they call a jungle primary. There's runoff primaries. I don't think it really matters for gender if you play by the rules. And again, the women have to be out there to run, right? And I think that is where we have the challenge, is that we still, despite the success of last year, we still, the usual suspects are still a bunch of dudes who show up when the time comes. And so I think as we look at the structure of our American democracy, which changes and varies across the 50 states and how you access the ballot and what the thresholds are, I will close on this. We do not have a perfect system, right? It was not set up to be perfect, our democracy, from the beginning in the Constitution. It's meant to evolve. It's meant to grow. It's why we have the amendments that have come over time to change it. But we will get better changes to our structure of government, to the things we talk about, to the way our government responds to communities across our country, when our government looks like the people it's trying to represent and work for. And that is fundamentally why the work I do makes me excited to get out of bed every day. And that is fundamentally the difference that I hope you can see and look a little bit deeper into as you play out and hopefully get involved in whatever that means to you in the 2020 election here in Maine. And in case you didn't know, if you're a student at the University of Maine, you can vote here. You can also vote at home, absentee, totally a great idea. Please participate. Please be a part of the solution. I look forward to voting for many of you in the future. Thank you for having me. This was such a treat.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Emily Kane, Executive Director of Emily's List. She recently gave this year's Distinguished Honors Graduate Lecture at the University of Maine, Orono, focusing on the future of women in our political landscape. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchak. Thanks for joining us.